The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. Today I'm speaking with storyteller Shannon Kaysen. Shannon Kaysen, thank you so much for taking the time to come on The Marrow. You are a storyteller. You have your own podcast, which is absolutely amazing. Everybody make sure you subscribe. It's called Homemade Stories. You are a regular on NPR Snap Judgment. You are a Grand Slam champion with The Moth. Thank you so much for coming on The Marrow today, Shannon.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course, man. I feel like maybe this is misguided because a lot of things I do are misguided, but I'm gonna ride that assumption and just assume you and I can dive right in. You are a storyteller, and so Shannon, my first question is what for you makes a good story?
Conflict makes a good story to me, and if it's an interesting conflict, that's always interesting to me. I mean, conflict is the thing that makes any story kind of run in a sense, but when I got into storytelling, like as far as like say the Moth type of storytelling, like storytelling on stage, you know, and a person taking personal narratives from their life, and I always was a little bored with the stories about, hey, I was 8 years old and I was going to Christian camp and, you know, and I was in the water and I was far out in the water and I made it back, you know.
Yeah. Right.
I'd be like,
right.
Who the fuck cares? You know what I'm saying? Excuse me if we can't cuss on this, but I'm like, hey, who cares, you know? But then, like, I would like the stories where the person would dive deeper and go into some of their vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. some of the stuff that they might have just felt the release to share or sharing because it might help somebody else. So I always like those stories better. Like, okay, a person dealt with addiction or a person dealing with abuse and being the abuser, maybe. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff is, it's like, man, they went there. I want to see if I can go that far.
Yeah, you know, right.
Talk about some stuff that I might not want to talk about and put it in a way. Because I always like that with stories, too. Like, if an author can write a story and it's about a deplorable person, and they've made this deplorable person seem human to me, or I relate mm-hmm. to this guy, mm-hmm. even though he's a serial killer or mm-hmm. a crazy guy, you know, and I relate to him. I'm like, dang, parts of me is in that too.
Yep.
You know, I think that's great storytelling.
Yeah, right.
You know, I feel that. Yeah.
Well, and for me, there's. Something about what you're saying that to me makes a great story is that a great story, at least for me, tends to have a real humanity in its characters, right? Even the ones that in theory or on the surface, my life has not mirrored. Or though I haven't maybe ventured down some of the same paths, if I remove just the physical decisions and I burrow in, or the teller invites me into the motivations behind those decisions, I see that I'm motivated by the same things. I see that maybe, you know, to use your example, in the serial killer, I see shame in them and I see shame in me. I see a longing to connect in them and I see a longing to connect in me. And to me, that's such a marvel in storytelling when it creates empathy for people that in theory were not alike at all. I mean, I love that. And to me, I mean, you know, there's so many ways to tell a great story. I mean, even if I look at some of the stories that I've connected with most over my, you know, 37 years, I mean, yeah, you know, Star Wars and The Godfather and you know, Where the Wild Things Are and Bugs Bunny, like whatever it is. But when I look over the whole spectrum, I mean, to me, I think at times when it comes to storytelling, we get too tactical. And to me, really, when all is said and done, I think in the simplest form, a great story is captivating. And however you get there, however the teller gets there, matters less than the fact that they are grabbing the hearts and minds of the audience, and they don't let them go. And even when they have uttered the last word, or when the credits have rolled, or when the last page has been turned, even then it's like that story doesn't just evaporate. It's like it just kind of lingers like fog in us. And to your point, I think oftentimes that is accomplished through that sense of conflict. But to me, at the end of the day, it's like it doesn't matter how you get there. It's like what matters is that it lingers inside of people when it's done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stick to the bones. Stick to you a little bit. I agree.
And you do that so well, Shannon. And you know, one story that I've heard you tell before is this actually incorporates some of the things you were talking about previously with the sense of kind of honesty. But you tell a story about you when you kind of had your eyes awakened to your gambling addiction. Would you mind telling the listeners of the Marrow that story?
Yeah, well, it was. I'd always been a gambler way back when I was a kid. You know, I just enjoyed it. You know, and through college, you know, I had I got involved in a church, and I remember the pastor had told people like, whoever's dealing with gambling addiction or whatever, you know, come up. Like lottery and all this kind of stuff, come up to the front. You know, I want to pray with you. And I went up to the front and I prayed. And I stopped gambling for a long, because we used to shoot craps in people's rooms and stuff like that. And I used to, you know, do a little bit here and there, but never anything real bad. But I knew I could spend more than I wanted to. And I stopped from there for about, I don't know, about 5 years. I just didn't gamble at all. Or nothing, you know, wouldn't even do a scratch off. And I had sex with the church secretary and kind of drew me away from the church a little bit.
Yeah, it tends to do that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Drew me away from the church a little bit, you know. And I got back in.
Wait, we just all need to marinate in that sentence that you just said. That is... And it kind of drew me away. You weren't folding bulletins or playing the organ anymore after that, huh, Shannon?
No, not as much. And then I got back into gambling. And then it went further than, you know, they say like if you you clean the house, all the demons or whatever, you know. But I don't know but you know what I'm talking about. And then they come back, though.
Yep.
If you don't, they come back stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had cleaned out my house, all that, and then I invited it back in, and it came back a lot stronger, and I started gambling real strong a lot and all the time, and ended up doing some things that I never even would expect myself to do. I stole money from my job, you know, to gamble, and I gambled $50,000 away in one day. And I tell the story about it and how I was dealing with that circumstance and how I was going to, you know, what was life going to be after. So it's like my life before that situation and then my life after that situation. And that's what the story was about, that particular moment, you know, and then a little bit beyond after that moment. So I told that story with Snap Judgment and with The Moth, but it took me a while to really want to share that story. I wrote that story, and then it took me about 2 years to decide to myself, I want to share that story. But it was in sharing that story, I wanted to share this story for somebody else who might be going through it. Maybe some college student doing the same things that I was doing. It may be somebody who have gone through the exact same thing and they just need somebody to relate to. So I told the story from a standpoint of the listener, you know, like I want people and to be honest about it and want the listener to gather something from it and just be honest about it for them, you know, more so than saying pretty words for myself or making myself look like, you know, hey, I got out of this situation. The story don't end in perfect, you know.
Sure.
A perfect upswing, you know, especially with addiction. I don't think it ever ends that way with anybody.
Yeah. I mean, like you said before, it's not like those demons are ever killed, they're just kind of constantly slumbering inside, right? And at any moment, they can wake up and wreak havoc not only in our lives but the lives of the people around us. And I mean that's something I really cherish about your art, is that there is that kind of constant rhythm of honesty, even when it's not necessarily an autobiographical story that you're telling or sharing. I mean, because your work, I mean, you know, in a genre sense, spans from fiction, you know, stories about career failures, stories about personal failures, stories about your marriage, stories about growing up, stories about becoming a father. But in all of them, I mean, there really is this constant tempo of honesty. And so, and maybe you already answered this, but I'd love to hear you talk more about it. I mean, for you, why is honesty so critical to storytelling?
Hey, first I'm going to say, you really listen to my stuff. I appreciate it. I really appreciate
that.
That's really cool.
Yeah, but Shannon, hold on a second, Shannon. I'm just going to go ahead and interrupt you for a second. Like, because what you do matters, you know, and I mean that. Like, it really, really matters. And, I mean, for me personally, as a kid, I struggled mightily to connect with people socially. I really did. And I masked it pretty well. But I felt so much pressure all the time. Like every time I was at school or trying out for a team or a play or whatever it was, I felt like my whole life outside of my room was a performance that I had to perform. And I hated that. And I found a kind of respite from that pressure and that fear and that anxiety in stories. And I just felt like I bonded with stories. And again, you know, those were in all forms, whether that was television or movies or books. But so when I cross someone who, you know, is a storyteller such as yourself, it matters to me. And I put it this way, and I mean this as a compliment, I feel safe in the presence of your stories. And I don't mean I feel comfortable. What I mean is I feel safe to look inside myself. I feel safe to examine my life. I feel safe to be inspired. I feel safe to own and acknowledge my shortcomings. I feel safe to not have answers. And that's a really that is a gift that you offer to people such as me. So I really am grateful.
I appreciate that, man. I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. I think my stories do resonate with some people who may have had some of those kind of feelings where being antisocial, because I was the same. Like, I had a lot of antisocial, like, even what I do now, people who know me from way back in the day, they'll be like, man, you were kind of quiet growing up. I don't see you on stage. Well, I'm still, you know, I'm not the boisterous guy, but I've tackled some of the things of, and I don't think I've ever been afraid to get on stage, and I've always been creative in those types of ways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just depending on what environment you're in, like if you're in Detroit in the 80s, like I might not have been as boisterous as what that era was, but at the same time, I was in it and I was viewing and I was, you know, mm-hmm. I was just myself, within myself, you know. So I mean, I think it resonated with a lot of people who may have not been the most, you know, like the loud guy in class or the even though I was that sometimes. So it depends, you know, because it's that whole thing. But with honesty, like I look at it as like, okay, for a story, like what am I really feeling? You know, not so much like what exactly sounds good, but if I'm talking about marriage, or if I'm talking about, and I think comedians do a really good job at this, you know, if I'm talking about my kids, you know, everybody has a story about how wonderful their kids are and how much they love them. But what if I'm thinking like, damn, I made a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And you may have them feeling sometimes,
yeah,
man, if I'd have just wore rubber that day. You know what I'm saying? But not saying you don't love your kids and everything else, but I think comedians can do that because it's within the joke.
Yeah,
but then
right.
What if in literature you can mm-hmm. do that? What if in storytelling you can do that? And I think that honesty resonates with some people who think the same way,
yeah.
but they'll never really say it. They never,
right.
you know, it's something that you just kind of keep deep inside, or you look at your wife and think, you know, wrong thoughts or something,
sure.
and you kind of like just bury it. And but some so sometimes I like to kind of play with that in storytelling and just be honest about the feeling that I'm having. And it doesn't mean that it won't follow through on it.
Right.
But it's just being honest. You
yeah.
know, being honest of my feeling at that moment, you know.
But that seems that seems like a rarity though. When you encounter something, or when I encounter something, or even culturally when we intersect in a moment that we feel like is truly honest. Because like you said, I think the temptation is to always voice or to articulate what we think we're supposed to feel, what we're supposed mm-hmm. to think. Like, what's the best day of your life? It's when my when Madison or Zoe were your two daughters. Or what's the best day of my life? When I married Kristen. Like that's what we're supposed to say, right? Like, we know, and somehow, like, that answer is going to ingratiate us into wider culture and go, see, I belong. I'm like you. I felt that too.
When see, the day I had a foursome, you can't see that. Yeah. You people look at you wrong
yeah.
and like,
yeah, or like, you know, when I had boneless buffalo wings at Chili's for a week straight, that was the best week of my life, you know, or whatever. But it's like, but to me, there's a real fear of being identified or labeled in these hidden emotions, these hidden thoughts, these things that often get, you know, pushed into the broom closet of our lives and going, I don't want people to think that, like you said. Because sometimes maybe I wonder if becoming a father was a mistake. I don't want people to think that that therefore means I do not love my daughters. And we're not good at kind of expressing fleeting emotions. Like we go, oh, if you felt this at all, that means that's the only thing you feel. And you don't. There's no room for like complexity in relationships or in life, you know?
But I think people understand, like your audience is smart. They're smart.
That's right.
And I think they understand if you say, man, I made a mistake,
mm-hmm.
is not saying that I don't love my
right.
my relationship or mm-hmm. my daughter or this. You know, you're just being honest at that moment.
Right.
And they know what you know, they can feel the complexity because mm-hmm. they know the complexity within their own lives,
sure.
you know. So
sure.
so I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly that that if you can go there, and then that's the thing of good storytelling as well. Like when you read a book by a good author, like, you know, like, I mean, he's popular, but like Cormac McCarthy, mm-hmm. I was reading Child of God, and mm-hmm. the guy is a necrophilia
yep.
and hermit and
yep.
but you like, man, don't hurt him, leave him alone,
yeah, right.
he's just having some, you know, you can relate to certain things because mm-hmm. the audience is smart. They know just because you bring up something negative that there's no that's wholeheartedly that's everything, that's like a cardboard character, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's within the storyteller to leave a little opening for the audience to kind of make their own assumptions, their own
yeah.
opinions, their own, bring their own life into it a little bit. You
and,
know?
And that, and I think that that brings up a great thought, not only about storytelling, but just, I mean, our art in general, right? Is that as artists, our job is not to tell the audience what to think. Our job is just to make something and let it go and give it enough breathing room and leave it open-ended enough so that they can find themselves in it. I mean, when it gets articulated so specifically, it's almost like we rob the listener, we rob the audience of their ability to wrestle with it. And that's really what makes a story, I mean, to me, that's oftentimes, you know, going back to what we were saying before, that's what enables a story to linger like that mist in someone's mind, is that mm-hmm. they're wrestling how they intersect with the characters or the narrative that they've just heard. And again, you do that. I mean, I'm reminded of a quote by Nietzsche, and he says, what does it really mean to treat someone else as humane? He asks kind of this rhetorical question. And then he says, to spare someone shame. And, you know, I don't know if that's the be-all, end-all definition, but I definitely think there's something really potent there, that sharing stories of honesty, and that are flawed and imperfect about our own lives or personal failures or whatever, in sharing that, we spare other people shame, because you're allowing them to sit there and go, I'm not the only one. And that spares someone shame. And I think your stories do that. But I want to, I mean, you mentioned, you were kind of alluding to your childhood in Detroit, which is where you grew up. And I want to go back to that. I mean, what role did stories play in your life? I mean, take us back to 4-year-old Shannon, 8-year-old Shannon, 12-year-old Shannon. What role did stories play in your life as a kid?
As a kid, I was I've always been like an observant kid, you know, and I would always like to be on the sidelines. I mean, I was part of everything, but I would be a observer of a lot of things. So I have friends. I always have friends who were funny. You know, we would crack jokes and have funny things that we'd do, like inside jokes that we would only know, you know. And so that was part of who I was too, like having friendships where we could have this joke in time. But then storytelling was partly that, me and friends telling stories amongst ourselves and having these jokes amongst ourselves. But then my mother would also, she was always a book reader, reading those Daniel Steele books and all them kind of books. So, and we would go to the library, you know, so she would get books, and I would always go to the astronomy section or the kids section or whatever, and always get books through there. So, you know, boredom can cause you to read. And so my family was actually a reader. My sister read a lot. My mother read a lot. So it kind of rubbed off on me in that sense. Mm. But then comic books happened and just take your mind on so many journeys through comic books. You know, and through high school, grade school, me and my friends would read comic books. We would try to make up our own stories. You know, we would think about these deep philosophical, you know, all of it was wrong. It was like weed talk, you know, but we'd be talking about like what things are, you know, what is wrong and right, and all this. We would be having these deep conversations based off of the comic books and stuff that we were reading. So it's just always been there for me to think, like to observe different things, to think about the story and different things. Yeah. Like I was even going to Walgreens today and a Christmas song was playing. Yeah. And I was thinking about a scene, you know, of a guy going to get his his pharmacy prescription and the Christmas music playing. And I'm, you know, my mind is just thinking of you know, the pedestrian parts of life that make stories kind of pop, you know.
Yep.
So I was just thinking of little things like that.
What was your, did you have a favorite comic book character in that adolescent era of life?
My favorite would have been Spider-Man, because I thought Spider-Man was funny. You know, and I also liked Silver Surfer, because Silver Surfer was deep and he would talk about deep stuff. So those were my two favorites. Like Silver Surfer would be out in the abyss of space and just thinking about these deep things and about what Galacticus is going to do next.
It sounds like, and maybe this is getting a little too Freud, and not to lay you down on the marrow psychiatrist couch here, Shannon, but it sounds like maybe you saw a little bit of yourself in the Silver Surfer. You're kind of cascading off in the abyss of life and pondering deep things.
It's probably a little bit of both, because I'm silly as hell too, you know. Yeah. And then Spider-Man to throw out that little silly stuff to make people laugh, and you know. So you're probably right. You probably saw a little bit of myself in both of them.
Mm-hmm. When I was when I first kind of began my romance with the world of comics, my family would you know, drive from the western suburbs of Chicago up to northern Wisconsin, like almost to the UP of Michigan, within about 30 miles of the UP. It's about a 6-hour drive. And during the summer, my parents had just this obsession with antique sales and garage sales and flea markets and auctions. And Shannon, I mean, they would wake us up, you know, sunrise on Saturdays. And I'm a kid, you know, I just want to eat Lucky Charms and watch cartoons. They wake me up at 6 a.m. And they would haul us off for a day of shopping, and we would bring home boxes and boxes of lamps, you know, that are in the shape of a mermaid, and old snowshoes, and a billiard set when we don't have a pool table. Like my parents, I mean, you referenced, you know, your own addiction earlier. I had a number of addictions in my family, and one of them was hoarding. So my parents were just always accumulating. And so I loathed this entire process, but we would always make one stop on Saturdays at this barn in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. I mean, it's out of screaming distance. I mean, if anything bad happens, no one's going to hear you. But in this barn, they had just this treasure trove of comics. And it was the weirdest thing. It was just this old couple that sold comic books out of a barn. And my mom and dad would take me there, and it was so meaningful to me. And I was just completely hypnotized, not only by the stories and the characters, but the artwork and the way those things, through that integration, just kind of swept me away. And so I started collecting comics. I held on to them, and they meant so much to me. And I think not only because I love the stories and love the characters and love the colorful panels, but it was also like I knew my parents were only taking me there because it meant something to me. I knew they wanted me to have that experience because it meant something to me. And while you maybe felt a little more congruent with the Silver Surfer or Spider-Man, and I thought they were cool.
Who was your favorite?
Man, I mean, you know, I mean, I loved Batman, which my wife would say, you know, is very, I don't know, is kind of alluding to a lot of the darkness in me. But I also love the Hulk. I think I love the Hulk because he was just like this. There was nothing calculated. He just got mad and broke stuff. like there was no, like, I don't know. There was nothing neat. There was nothing refined. The superpower, if that's what you call it, could even only be activated by something almost that he didn't want. So to me, there was always a little bit of like, and now I see this more looking back, but there's like a, he's, to me, he's more of a tragic figure. Like, he's like more of a, to me, a Shakespearean comic character, because he doesn't want this, and a lot of times he can't even control it. But I always just connected with him. And then there was that. Did you ever watch the Lou Ferrigno Hulk TV show, where he got spray painted green and had those like purple pants that you were always worried were going to come completely undone when he got all swollen up? But man, I don't know. I absolutely adored that stuff.
Yeah.
So are you now? I mean, because you're, correct me if I'm wrong, you are a father of Zoe and Madison, right? You have two girls.
Two girls.
Mm-hmm. Now are you? Now what kind of stories do you like to tell your daughters?
Well, you know, my daughter, Madison, she lives with her mom, and I don't see her as much as I would like to. Mm-hmm. But then Zoe lives with me, and we share stories. We make up stories. So we'll she is into the YouTube video, and she watch a lot of the YouTube channels where the kids just kind of like talk about toys, or they talk about some video games or things. But occasionally we'll make our own videos. So we'll do videos of, I remember we did a video like her dolls coming to like attack her or something. So we just kind of like show them slowly moving closer, and she's kind of going away and she doesn't see them. They ain't coming around the corner to get her. They eat the cat, you know? So it's like a scary movie, type of video. And then we made another video of a unicorn in the basement. And they have all these programs on you can do a lot of this stuff on your phone. But I like that she enjoy acting out the parts and stuff. So we'll talk about like what her what's going to happen in the next scene, and what her motivation or what her expression has to be for this scene, you know. And that's fun to do with her, you know. And I get, being like liking stories, I get pretty intense in it too. So I'm like, no, we got to reshoot that one. Because it did, you know.
Take
we gotta 80. We gotta get a different angle. So we're gonna reshoot it so we can have separate angles when it happens. You know, so we'll have fun with that. And I think that's just an enjoyable thing. And then it's just good for her to see the creativity in it, and she'll show her friends and all that kind of stuff. So that's fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and what a gift, right? I mean, to stoke the imagination of someone else. I mean, what a, like, an amazing gift. I think if I'm remembering this right, you know, Lewis Carroll, the author of Alice in Wonderland and that whole collection of books, the way all those books started, if I remember right, is him and his daughter, who I believe was actually named Alice, would ride, go on little boat rides together on these like rivers, and he would row. And in order to kind of, expand her mind and her creativity and imagination, he started telling her these impromptu stories about a girl named Alice, but they were just off the top of his head. I mean, probably much like you're doing with your daughter, right? And
awesome.
And these stories, you know, about white rabbits and Cheshire cats and the Queen of Hearts and Tweedledee and Tweedledum would later become this, like, just iconic story that has really obviously endured while a lot of other stories have passed away. But it all started, if I'm remembering this right, the way you are with your daughter, that he's just like, I just want my daughter to be swept away. I want her to know I love her. I want to fuel her imagination. So that's how it all started.
That's amazing. Because you think about that too, the gift of a story or the gift of different creative things, they aren't that difficult. You know, a lot of times, and they don't always have to be super contrived either. They can just come to you like that. Like, you know, your daughter and you on the boat and you just coming up with these stories. And sometimes those are like the best stories. Yeah. Like, I've had that happen to me a few times where a story just was totally given to me. It wasn't even me. You know what I'm saying? I could just see the story. I remember I came home once and I told her a full story. You know, and I was just like, man, I was just walking home and I just was, and then I had to write it and it came out like, just like that, you know what I'm saying? Because I was just writing what I remembered, you know, and that's a beautiful place where you can have those kind of moments like he probably had with his daughter where the story just like was delivered, you know,
well,
in a sense.
And so I have a question about that, because as you know, and as I know, and as any creative or just anyone in life knows, sometimes it comes easy, right? Sometimes it's like, it does feel like it gets mailed down to you from wherever. But then other times it feels like, you know, you're trying to tunnel to the center of the earth and you're having to do it with your fingernails and scratch and claw. So my question is, like, Shannon, like, what do you do? And how do you approach it? And I'd love to hear you talk about this, both like, how do you feel emotionally in this, but also from a practical standpoint, what do you do when you're stuck and when it doesn't come as easy as some of the moments to which you were just referring?
Yeah, you can't wait on those deliveries, those mail deliveries of full stories, if you're going to do something, because that's that's like here nor there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like almost that zone. Like, you can't really, like, I mean, you can try to get all the things in order for that zone to hit or for that for the delivery to come, but you can't really just wait on that, because you might not get it again, or you may not it may not happen as often as you need it to happen. But you gotta always be writing. You know, if you're a writer or storyteller or those types of things, always thinking in stories, and those you know, always kind of like developing scenes, like I just talked about, being in the Walgreens and kind of just walking through and thinking of a scene, you know, of a guy going through the Walgreens. So just always be in that mind state of story. But for me, it's nurturing that. So thinking of those things, and I'll say I'm in my recorder on my phone, and I'll try to, you know, I won't go back to it, but many times just me saying it in the recorder on my phone, I'll bring it like a heavier memory for me to remember to kind of use that. And I keep notebooks, so I write down things. I'm like a little junior reporter. I'll write down little things that I'll see throughout the day. Now, if I go back to it or not, me writing it down kind of cements it in my mind to use it at a later date or in a story somewhere. So I keep my notebooks and my and all those things, but then I try to write as much as possible. And then also I think it's a decision. Like, when I get stuck or when I get caught, you know, it's all a decision. The story can go numerous different ways.
That's right.
I just make a decision and say, well, it's going to go this way. It could go a whole bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. It's going to go this way. And if I just make that decision and move on in that decision, it don't mean I can't go back and change that later and say, you know, that was a bad decision. That's the one thing about writing and storytelling. You can go back and edit, you know.
Yeah.
You can't edit life.
Yeah,
that is
right.
But wouldn't that be awesome if you could edit life? That would be kind of, that's like a Black Mirror episode or whatever, you know. You can go back and edit something.
Wait, so hold on. So if you could, Shannon, I mean, let's just play this nefarious game. Game that you have now started. If you could edit your life, is there one particular era or moment that you would edit and revise?
I mean, it's probably a bunch of moments that I could go back. You know, I probably would have went to school away from Michigan. You know, I probably would have ventured out away from my hometown.
Because you went to Michigan State, right?
I went to Michigan State, which is about an hour and a half away from Detroit. So I probably would have went somewhere further out, like Chicago somewhere or something. Because I just think my mind needed a different experience. You know, my mind, it's funny how it can be insulated in certain areas. You know, you can feel like to step beyond something, you're out of ordinary, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was probably more out of ordinary for my family than anybody else in my family. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was always limited. I had a limited mindset. I have to fight that now, mm-hmm. even in my life, and not think limiting, you know. And I think culturally you can kind of get in that way. And I think if I'd have moved even further away at a younger age, I would have been a little bit more willing to dive into different things. I mean, I started writing in my 30s, you know. I started a lot of things later in life, which were always there in the first place. They were always there. I just didn't think that that's what you do. You think you get a job at the plant, or you get a job at, you know, some job and work up the corporate ladder. My mind wasn't seeing other ways that people could do things. I mean, to write a movie, to stand on stage and 1,000 people listen to your story, that wasn't even on the radar for me. Unless I was at a church or I was a pastor or something
Right.
That wasn't a thought in my mind.
Yeah.
So I just wish I would have had those experiences to push myself further earlier in life. So that's one thing I would have did. And then I wouldn't have, a lot of things I wouldn't have done, you know. Now stealing the money, gambling addiction, all those things, I don't know. That probably was in me. I probably couldn't edit that out of my life.
Yeah.
You know, you get what I'm saying? It may have came out in a different way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd have made certain edits. My ex-wife, I don't know, you know. I got a beautiful daughter, so.
Okay, so Shannon, I'll tell you one of mine. I'll tell you an edit.
What would you edit?
I mean, and this is, well, you judge what this is. But so one of the first tattoos I got, I think before we were actually on the air, we were talking about my tattoos, both seriously and comedically. but one of the first tattoos I got was for a girl I was dating when I was 18. Okay? So, of course I was 18, and of course I was in love, and of course we were going to be together for the rest of our lives, right? So I thought, what better way to communicate the sonnet of my heart than to tattoo it on my arm? Now, this is where it gets really humiliating. I mean, and you've alluded to this, like there's layers to every emotion in every moment, right? And it's always a question of how deep are you going to go? And so I'm tempted right now to just leave it there, but I feel compelled to actually tell you what the tattoo was. So
that's good.
This girl, we met in the Chicago suburbs when I was in college, and she was from the state of Maryland. And I didn't want to get her name on my arm. I thought, well, that's too on the nose. You know, I want to be a little more subtle than that. So I'm thinking, well, what do I know about this girl? And after I go through my Rolodex of information, I realize she's from Maryland. So, Shannon, I decide to get tattooed on my arm, thinking the best way to pay an homage to her is to get the University of Maryland Terrapin tattooed on my arm. And so, and of course, I'm 18. So when you mention this to your friends, they're all like, this is a good idea. You need to do. They're not going.
What's a terrapin? What's a terrapin?
It's like it's an angry turtle. You can look it up online. It's a red and yellow angry, ferocious turtle holding the letter M. So Shannon, I get this permanently carved on my body. And so, of course, within months, the relationship's over. And so now how do you explain it away? And so I'm crafting, whenever I'm asked, these long, elaborate narratives. Oh, well, I have an ancestor, and he was at the, you know, you make all this stuff up to try to make yourself not seem so foolish. Uh-huh. So I would edit that moment, but while you cannot edit your life, you can edit tattoos. And so I actually got this tattoo covered a few years later, but when I get really hot or really nervous, you can actually see the imprint of this first tattoo kind of rising up on the skin beneath it. And so even now, my wife just relishes in the moments when she can kind of gnaw on me, relating back to that moment in life. So I mean, that's a more.
Did you get something of your wife?
No.
Did you ever get anything?
No,
a subtle, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Maybe like that's like the kiss of death. I don't know if that's like the kiss of death, if I get it. Like, but she would never be, she would never feel, you know, that was an appropriate expression of my love for her. I think for her, she's more like, be good to me, love me, encourage me, you know, be there for me. I think she's more interested in that than any, you know, decor of the flesh. But that's like a moment, like a more comedic moment. But if I could go back and edit, you know, a more impactful moment of my life, I have a friendship that fell apart when I was 23. And I'd been friends with this individual for a decade. And we had always been different. I mean, his life had always been harder than mine, in the sense that he got kind of swallowed up into, you know, drugs and heavy drugs, heavy drinking, got into drug dealing, was in prison for a while. I mean, I remember going and visiting him on, you know, Christmas and everything. But eventually, Shannon, I don't know if I made the right decision, man. But eventually I realized that I was becoming like him in a way that I didn't want to. And I felt like I was starting to kind of, I don't know, I guess I didn't feel like my friendship with him was serving us anymore, helping either of us. And so I sat him down one day and I said, I was like, hey, man, I was like, I love you, but I just can't do this anymore. I was like, I feel like you're destroying your life, and I feel like I'm not doing anything about it. And so our friendship severed, and I've tried to, you know, I've asked him for forgiveness. It's crazy. It's been almost 15 years, but I mean, I've asked him for forgiveness multiple times since then, and you know, he's just not there. But I don't know. I look back on that moment, and some days I think I did the right thing. And then other days I look back and I go, I hate what I did, you know. And so maybe what I would love to edit, I would love to edit the outcome. I don't know if I should have done something different. Maybe I should have, but I definitely wish I could edit the outcome, so it would become the happy Hollywood story I think I envisioned, where, you know, he kind of went through a personal renovation, and so did I, and we reconnected, and maybe that's still ahead of us, you know, maybe it is, but I would absolutely edit that moment of my life, Shannon.
Yeah, maybe that is still ahead of you. You know, that's a good way to think about it as well. You know, because I got friendships as well where I'm. You know, my faith is in that we'll connect again stronger, you know, because a lot of friendships are part of who we are. You know, a lot of my friendships, same, sound like that guy, you know, a lot of him is in you, a lot of you is in him.
And, yeah, that's right.
And you can never deny that. I don't care how old you get. I saw a friend yesterday at a funeral, and we hadn't seen each other probably 20 years or so. you know, his uncle died and lived on the same block, and I went to the funeral. Because I've been gone from Detroit for a while, but we saw each other, you know, as much as we look different now, you know, we just looked, and he's sitting on the front row, you know, he was the, and we just, I was like, his name Freddie, but I call him Mickey, you know, from way back when. I'm like, Mickey. He look at me, we like, you know, it's a funeral, but we just smiling big, just looking at each other, because we were kids, and we got some things. And when I came back around and saw him, he was like, man, you see this right here on my eye? I'm never going to forget you. You kicked that crate and hit me. You know, it's just like we know each other deeper than deeper. Even if we ain't seen each other in a while, we know each other from those foundational periods. So, you know, it's good when you connect with people who made you who you are in that sense, you know. And I got a few friends that I don't speak to, and I hope to one day be able to connect again with. So Neil, if you're listening to this, man, connect with a brother.
Well, that's so true. I mean, about friendships, relationships, and I don't know. I think that's one of the really miraculous things about stories is all the moments of our lives, not just our lives, but our families, or even expanded out to our cultures, all the stories that have ever happened, I mean, they're kind of always silently being told and retold, right? I mean, they're always a part of us like those friendships are. It's like the moments that happened to you when you were 12 or 15, even though you may forget them, there's still kind of this silent narrator inside of you keeping those stories alive. I mean, and that's certainly true of our culture. I mean, you know, that's been so evident in the last few years, that so much of the history of our country, even the recent history of our country, it's like the tensions, the wounds, the hurt, the victories, the good, the bad, it's always there. And sometimes those stories are told audibly, but like they're always kind of, I don't know, in the current of everything that we're doing. So,
I say this one time. I agree with you there on stories, and I think it's important to get our family stories as well. Like to go back and I've interviewed my dad. I've interviewed my mother. I want to interview my uncle, because a lot of those stories you miss. Like my grandmother has dementia, and I don't have her stories. You know, she doesn't talk anymore. So I think that's important to get those people before you. Try to get as many of their stories as well. So I'm planning on interviewing my parents more, my uncles and aunts more, and get a lot more of those stories. So I agree with what you said. Yeah, and it's not like it's not macro like the whole country, but it's your life, you know, and then your kids to be able to know the stories and from their own voice, you know, like we got these microphones right now, get their voice on camera. I mean, on tape and talk to them about their lives. But we only got a few more. So
I want to hear more about that, because you have such a, I sense this in you, not only in your art, but just in talking with you. But you have a very kind of reflective method of life. You reflect on your life. You think about moments. You pause. You're introspective. There's contemplation. And even what you're talking about now with your family and wanting to pause and actually connect. Do you find, what as a culture do we miss when we're so busy about our own lives that we don't pause to do those things? Like, what do we kind of lose as a culture?
I think we discount a lot of people. We discount, you know, we might discount somebody who's older, or we might discount somebody who's younger, or we may, sometimes I've talked to people and I'm talking to someone and someone more important walks in the room, and all the energy slides to the person who's more important, and who they perceive to be more important. And I notice those things, you know, and it may be the guy who's the least important in the room may have something for you, you know, instead of you gathering around this one famous person in the room. What about that guy in the corner there? And let's talk to him. So I've always kind of been interested in the guy in the corner there. You know, I've just always been interested in what he's thinking or what's going on with him, or want to be friends with that guy. I think that's pretty much even in my own, my single life, I didn't really gravitate towards the person who, you know, getting all the attention in the room. I'd be like, man, the girl in the corner, she fine too. Let me go talk to her. Let me go talk to her. And usually she'd be the most interesting person in the room. So I always, because I think we discount young people, not really listen to what they're saying. Mm. You know, so I want to work more with some young people and hearing their stories. Mm. And older people, you know, we'll look for them to tell these nice, wholesome stories. Some of these older people have some some different kind of lives, you know. Yeah. So when I talk to my dad, I want my dad to talk, you know, man to man with me, tell me about everything. So in our conversation we had, he talked about, you know, being a pimp in the 60s and 70s at one time. He talked about, you know, I want to hear about his first marriage because I never heard much about that. I want to hear about how he met my mom, you know, and not the nice, wholesome way, you know, tell me the real story on things that happened. Cause I think that's something of value to my family, my life, and maybe be able to use that in stories or just to share with my kids later on as they get the age to listen to it, you know.
Yeah, well, and not only does that encourage us, I mean, for me, not only does that, I don't know, that approach to relationships in life give me the opportunity to slow down, to be quiet, but in that space of silence, it allows me to connect with people and to kind of deepen my existence with another person. Like, there are so many things, but both, you know, I mean, there's so many things I wish I could ask my grandparents. I actually went this past January. My grandma had hip surgery, and she couldn't, the hospital wouldn't release her unless she had a family member there. And her husband has passed away, and her daughter, my mom, has also passed away. And so me and my two sisters all drove to Eastern Ohio in this little town, and we spent a week with my grandma. And it was just sitting there and going, what was grandpa like? Or what was it like when you worked at the radio station, you know, right after World War II? And you hear these things. And I suppose, you know, Shannon, like, some of it is foreign, some of it's funny. And you hear the same stories told like 17 times in the same hour. But then some of it, to me, does exactly, you know, it accomplishes the same thing that great storytelling, like we were talking about in the beginning, accomplishes. It humanizes my grandma. It humanizes some of my ancestors that just seem kind of like these one-dimensional archetypes. They don't seem like people. But when my grandma says things like, she told me this story that her and my grandfather had 23 beagles, 23. And my grandpa, who always seemed for me, as a child of the late 70s, he always seemed like this very kind of austere and harsh man. You know, he worked in a steel mill. He was just kind of like man's man, like a lot of those, you know, early century men were. But when she told me the story about how my grandfather, if ever it rained, was insistent that all 23 beagles slept in the house, it cast him for me with this sense of just compassion and tenderness that I had never met. And she told this story to me. She said, Josh, I saw your grandfather cry one time, and he had gone hunting with his favorite beagle of the 23. And they're out, and he had spent the whole day away. And he came home that night, pulled into the driveway, same house they'd lived in for 40 years. And he didn't come in the house right away like he normally did. And the dog didn't jump out of the passenger seat of his rusty green truck like it normally did. Instead, my grandfather walked to the back of the truck, took down the tailgate, and then reached into the back, and he picked up the beagle that had died while they were hunting. And he came up the stairs, and he actually brought the dead dog into the house, into the kitchen. And my grandma came out, and she said, what happened? And as she tells me the story, she said, and your grandfather just sobbed like a little boy. And I don't know why that's so moving for me. Like, I'm crying now thinking about it, but I think I just go, wow, like, I don't know, maybe that's what it is. That glimpse of my grandfather's humanity allows me to connect with him or deepen my existence with him in a way that just all the kind of static, this was my job, I was born in this year, don't do. And mm-hmm. and I don't know, I mean, that is, you know, one of the many powers of storytelling.
You should have pressed record on that phone while grandma was talking.
Oh man.
I tell you, that's what I be telling people to do. I be like, you had these conversations. I ain't asking my dad if I can record him. My dad, I'm going to press record.
I don't have permission
to use it. Right. You know what I'm saying? But I tell my dad that I'm going to record him because he like being on tape. But yeah, just that's wonderful, man. And I mean, taking them time just to, like, it's a character that I like. Guy Walter Mosley, he write this character, Easy Rollins. He's a detective, a private detective. But he's a private detective in like L.A. in the 60s and 70s or whatever, in the 60s, I believe. But he'll just go around, and sometimes he'll sit on people's porch and just talk to people, you know. And I always thought, man, that's cool. I remember that, just going to sit on people's porch. You know, you just sit on some old folks' porch and just sit there and just watch the street.
Yeah.
And then maybe an hour within sitting there, they'll start to talk and tell you some stories and talk about some stuff. And, you know, it just be like cool. That kind of stuff is cool to me. So even listening to you and your siblings driving out there and just spending time, after about a week's time, you just kind of relaxed and you almost get used to being there. Even though you probably like, man, I got so much stuff I need to do.
Yeah.
But then it probably was hard to leave. You're like, man, I enjoy being here.
Yeah, right.
That's how grandma's house was all the time. You're like, man, I don't want to go to grandma's house. She's going to make me have to weed the garden or something. I'm going to have to do all this other stuff. But then you sit there with your grandma about that weekend, and then your mother come back in, and all the, you know, real life is coming back in the door. Your mama with, you know, talking loud, and y'all about to go somewhere out to eat or something. And you're just like, man, I kind of enjoyed this time with grandma.
Absolutely.
I don't want to leave right now.
Well, you know? and you know, Shannon, one of the things that you remind me of is that to be a really effective storyteller, we have to be a listener of other people's stories. Right. I mean, we have to receive stories in order to really be able to maximize our capacity to tell them. Shannon, before we go, I said it at the top, but how can people find you? I want people to listen to your art, to your work. How can people find you and gather more of what you're doing?
Well, definitely wherever you find podcasts, look up Shannon Kaysen's Homemade Stories. You can just put in Homemade Stories and give a listen there. And also at ShannonKaysen.com. My last name is Kason, and Shannon, just like regular spelling, but ShannonKaysen.com. And you can find everything there as well. But yeah, listen to a few of the stories, and hopefully they bring you in to listen to all of them.
Yeah, so, yeah. Everybody, go, please subscribe. Don't just listen to Homemade Stories with Shannon Kaysen. Please subscribe. It's really great work. Shannon, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Mero today. I'm a fan of your work. I'm grateful for the guy that you are, and I hope you and I get to intersect again before too long. Thanks so much, Shannon.
Thank you. Glad to know you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mero. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. But please join me again next week.